Welcome back. Yeah, we've covered a lot today. We've talked about getting everything set up and, you know, going through all the process of getting all your classes ready for rendering and that. And we've now got some objects showing up on the screen. So it's kind of come to that point where we should probably start letting the user interact with the game, right?
That'd be a good idea. yeah, what we're going to do is we're going to start with capturing user input for this module. And what we want to do is we want to aggregate input from multiple sources. So I'm going to show you a way to handle and set up a class that can listen for input from your mouse, your keyboard, touch device, the controller, and bring it all together so that the game only responds really to a proper range of input at one point and not multiple at the same time because two people are using two different devices for fun pushing forward to see if they can run twice as fast. And that sounds funny, but I've actually done it in multiple games before, just gone in there and be like, oh, this it supports controller and keyboard? What happens if I hold forward on both? And you'd be surprised by how many games you can actually like do twice as fast movement or do more jumps.
Yeah, some fun inputs like that. That, yeah.
So we're going to look at aggregating that all together into one, so that you only get one input at a time coming through, and it ignores other inputs and so on and so on, but still supporting all the different devices that we could be doing. So we'll look at capturing that input and then how to apply that input into the game after that step. All right, so aggregating input from multiple sources. For this demo, we wanted to support all of the available input devices commonly used to play games on Windows 8.1. So that means we have four different sources at this point to deal with. So we're going to create a single class that's going to aggregate the input from all of those sources into one meaningful place, which means that we can grab and react to that input from anywhere else in the code much more quickly and efficiently because it's all being handled by the same class itself. So to further simplify things, we can also have that base class interpret the input data and return it through specialized getters to other classes in that game in different forms if we need to. And that way, everything is centralized and still easily accessible. So we wanted to support keyboard input, mouse input, gamepad input, touch input. Those are the four that we were going to look at. And of course, the first step is creating that single class. So input is delivered in the form of events, basically. So all if you've done any other programming in other languages, there's usually event listeners, we call them sometimes, and that kind of stuff. Basically, somebody else is raising an event, you need to listen for it, capture it, and now do something about it. So all device input is passed to your application through events from the Windows core system. All we have to do is register event handlers within our class to listen for and then respond to each of those expected event types that we want to, you know about in an individual class. So of the four input sources that we want to support, the keyboard is the easiest one to work with in the beginning because really it only has two events that we want to listen to, key up, key down, and that's it. Two basic events. So we're going to take a look first at that and how to grab that input, respond to that input. That's going to be your example. And then from there, you can extrapolate how to do the other ones, which are going to be very similar, except for the controller, which we're going to look at separately using X input. So first, during our initialization of the class, you will want to create an event handler. And you can see by the code here on the slide. To do that, in the MoveLook controller initialize, I've pretty much just crush this function down from what it is in the actual code source into just this part that we care about. It takes in the core window that is dealing with this app, and then it's just going to tell it with the plus equals operator, which has been overwritten, so that we can set up an event handler using that and tell it what we want to listen to. So in this case, we want to listen to the key down and the key up events, and we want to tell it what function we would like it to call within our code base when those events take place. So at the end of this line of code here, you can see that we go along and type event handler. We're going to need to listen to who sent us this message, and we're going to need to know what it is they're trying to tell us. All right, and then we're going to say, okay, on this class that we're in, I would like you to call the onKeyDown function that we haven't written yet, but we will. And the onKeyUp function of this class, again, whenever you hear these two events coming from that window. And that's it. That's the basic setup for that kind of system. Now, you can also unsubscribe from an event by using minus equals instead of the plus equals here. You can use minus equals to unsubscribe from an event later on at any point in time. There are certain cases where you want to do that. For example, maybe you only want to listen to, mouse input when they're in their submenus or something like that. Other than that, we don't need the mouse, so we don't bother listening to it. You don't want to waste time, you know, listening to mouse events if the person hits the mouse or knocks it, like I've done today already a couple times, because they might change slides on you, and you don't want that to happen. So you could tell the system to stop listening to that input because he's busy talking about this slide, and then go back to it later. So just something I wanted to point out so that people know how to manage which events you're listening to and from at any point in time. You can turn them on, turn them off using plus equals and minus equals in a similar fashion. So you'll probably see that in other setups as well. Now, typically when we're dealing with those event handlers, just remember that you will want to unsubscribe at the end. Now, because we are doing a game, and in this case it's a simple game, we pretty much want to listen the whole time that the game's running, and we never want to stop listening for any of those inputs. So in this case, you won't find anywhere in the code where I've unsubscribed from the events, simply because we never need to in this case, but you may need to in your own setup or game. So now that we're listening for that event or those two events, what does the receiving function need to look like in order to handle the event? Well, all of those event handler functions, for example, in this case, our onKeyDown function that we've created, need to, again, accept who is sending this message, so the core window in this case, a pointer to that, and a pointer to the arguments list or structure, depending on the kind of event that we're dealing with. Now, in this case, it's a key event argument structure, but with the mouse, it'll be something different, and so on and so on, and touch, for example, or cursor, I believe it's called, those events will have a slightly different structure there. So that one name there as the second parameter, this piece will change depending on what kind of event we are dealing with. So in this case, it's a key event, so we're good. And you can see that I'm going to want to know what key we are dealing with. So I've made a variable called key, which is of type virtual key from the Windows system library, or namespace rather. And then now I'm going to grab out of the arguments parameter that got passed in the key that they're telling me about this event is about. Now, it might be a key I care about. It might also be a key I don't care about. Maybe he dropped his Coke on the keyboard and it's rolling across the keyboard, punching a bunch of random letters. We don't want to know about that. We only care if they push WASD or P in this game, P for pause and WASD for moving your guy around. So we figure out that the command from the keyboard, we want to see that key if it equals W in this case. And if it does equal W, we're going to set a flag to true that you're moving forward. Okay, and that's it. Now, obviously, if you look at the code base, this has been expanded so that you can do W, A, S, D, and P for pausing and so on and so on. But that's effectively all that's going to happen on key down. Oh, you've touched this. I'm going to internally in this class set an appropriate flag to true or carry out some other action. In this case, we're only setting something to true. We don't want to actually respond to, oh, W, move the guy. We don't want to do that yet. We want to make sure that we get all of the input from all of the devices and then decide what to do going forward.
Well, that'll stop what you were talking about earlier, right?
It'll help with two things that do the same thing. If I was holding up on the controller and pushing W, you sort of want to be able to mitigate one or the other or both and then move on from there. So for now, it's just setting a flag that will let us know later on when we actually update the controller, and we saw where that was happening previously. In the update loop, it says, you know, controller.update, and that's when it'll be, oh, it says I should be moving forward. It's true. Now I'll respond with a velocity of a certain amount or something. So the basic process for capturing the player input is to register an event handler and an associated callback. Okay, this is just a recap of the basic process. Then we write the callback to accept the sender and argument parameters and determine what actual key or button or movement or event took place and update our internal state of our movement controller accordingly. And that's really all there is to it. Now, to write that callback function again. We have to accept the core window pointer as a sender and so on. And that's because of the Windows Store integration and then how we're building everything in to the Windows 8.1 environment. So again, that would be one of those things that would be slightly different if you were to do this for Windows 7 and backport to another version to support that and so on that people were asking about earlier. So we've demonstrated the key down process. The key up process is going to be pretty much the same thing. When we let go of a key, it's going to raise another event called the key up event. It's going to now call our on key up event function because we were listening for that event. And then it's going to do something like set that the forward variable if he was letting go of W to false so we know we're not moving forward again anymore. Those kinds of things. And that's really all there is to it. So it's the exact same process we just did for on key down, but now for on key up. And that's pretty much all there is to it. Now, dealing with pointer event arguments and mouse event arguments, pointer being your touch input and cursor sort of finger going around on thing that they called a pointer event argument, slightly different, but again, it's still the same process. We register to listen for a mouse click or a mouse move, and then we specify what function we'd like them to call when that happens and handle a specific kind of argument, do whatever we want, done. So it's the same still process, but what's in those event arguments is going to be a little bit different. Now, obviously, there's not going to be key names of what key they pressed because they're moving the mouse or clicking one of the buttons or something like that. It's going to be slightly different where they're touching on the screen and so on. So we're going to have to handle that in a slightly different manner. Now, for controller input, it's a completely different system. So we've covered how to capture three of the four sources. Let's look at the gamepads as our next one. It's handled in a completely different way. We use a polling system to check for input. So we constantly ask sort of this internal state system of the gamepad, you know, what's your current state? And then we evaluate what we want to do about that. Oh, I notice the A button is held down. I'll do this. Oh, I know you're moving the move stick forward. Let's do that. So we're constantly grabbing from the gamepad an input state to see what we want to do there. So it doesn't use event handlers or callback functions in this case. The other three do, this one does not. All right. Instead, we're going to be polling that system, checking for any changes each frame, and then to the end, we're going to basically use that, apply that logic, integrate it in with the rest of those internal states due to events, and then compile it all together and hand out some kind of useful input. So we use the X input API for access to that to any controllers really attached to the system at any given time, even a dance pad. Okay, if you want to control these sumos with dance pads, you could plug them in, give it a shot.
I think that'd be kind of fun, actually.
Yeah, I can't verify that it will work. I don't own a dance pad, unfortunately, and I couldn't test it, but the X input API will allow you to do all of those kinds of external device kind of setup, and that's really what it was meant for. So it's a neat thing, you know, maybe somebody wants to try that and let us know how it goes, you know, later on when you got it. So you can also get battery information, for example, from the device. If it has batteries, like because it's a wireless controller and they've got the power pack in, so you can warn the user, hey, your battery pack's getting low, and show a little indicator or whatever. All that kind of information is what's in DirectX 11's X input API. So it's a really nice compilation of systems for external gamepad and devices. Get all that control, get that extra input, and figure out what's really going on.
In the system that you kind of set up, even if, like, say, you wanted to plug in a Kinect or something, mm-hmm. right, you would be able to do this because you could just take, you know, obviously you have to write the code to handle the Kinect
sure.
events.
Yep.
But you could take this into consideration when you're adding all these states to the end result, right?
Correct. You could. It would be a similar process. You would want to get your data or get your input from it, and then again set internal flags and internal states to deal with whatever that input was, so that when we get to the update function of the controller, it would now evaluate, oh, he's leaning right, I should dodge right, he's leaning left, I should dodge right, whatever it is, you know, he's pushing forward, so let's move the sumo forward. You know, you could do whatever you want there. You'd have to interpret it again, and that's what's nice about this class setup, is that it doesn't matter what device you want to use. They all funnel into this nice same area. We then deal with all of the input together, and we hand out to the game the specific pieces of information it needs whenever it requests what the current velocity of the character is, for example, and so on, so that we know and we can properly render and then update the physics system with it.
Very cool.
Yeah, so that's how that works. So why not take a look at it? Okay, so we're going to take a look at how we go about grabbing these event handlers and the gamepad polling system. We'll take a look at that because, again, it is slightly different. So we're just going to take a look at where that's implemented in the code base so that you can find it easier from what we've been talking about and what we've been referencing. All right, so here is the move look controller's initialize function. And basically, I'm talking to the core window, and I'm saying, okay, when the pointer is pressed, you know, let me know about that by calling on pointer pressed, which is a function that's somewhere else in here that we've written. Okay, and same with pointer moved, pointer released, pointer exited, and so on, all the way down. Those are all of our touch input ones. There's our key down and our key up. Okay, and again, they're all linked now to some internal function in this class that we would like it to call whenever one of those events occur. So you can see there's no difference in listening for key down versus whether or not he's released the pointer or moved it. It's still just an event, and that just calls another function, and that's it. Now, there is a separate handler for mouse-only relative mouse movement events. For example, when the mouse is moved. Okay, so this part is separate from the pointer part. The clicking is still done through the pointer click events. Sorry. And then the mouse moved ones are separate events. So we do have to listen for that one separately because it is different than dragging your finger around on the screen, mm-hmm. for example, and that on. So it has its own mouse moved event, which we are going to call on mouse moved function to handle just the mouse cursor being moved around. Of course, they can't see the mouse cursor because we've hidden it on them, so there's nothing distracting flying around on their screen. We've already taken care of that. They just effectively feel like they're directing their sumo by waving the mouse back and forth and so on. Or in this case, actually, the mouse is bound to the camera.
I was going
to
say, yeah, it's the camera that's moving
so
in this case.
Yeah. I just wanted to show something different, same kind of application, but being able to pivot your view around. And another reason why I wanted to put that in there is for, again, beginners, when you're building DirectX, sometimes you've made a mesh and you've hooked up all the buffers and you've got something rendering and you think it's great and you run it and then you can't see anything. Okay, you can't see anything because you accidentally put it behind the camera or the camera's just facing the wrong direction. So I left this controlled to the mouse so that you can move the camera around a little bit. I did constrain it so that you wouldn't accidentally spin the game around and not be able to see. So I did keep it within the cone of arc of that gameplay area. But you could go ahead and remove those constraints or rejig how the input happens so that you can look around in a full 360 degree sphere in any direction you want if you choose. But I just wanted to show you how that mouse input can use that camera so you can look around in case you start spawning new objects and you can't see where they are, just to maybe find them off screen or wherever. So that's important to have. I always recommend people have that early on, is to have some kind of camera movement ability, because sometimes it's just hidden off screen and you just don't know it. You think everything's broken, but you're still actually in running order. All right, so after that, this is just resetting the state of the controller, but has nothing to do with the input events itself. So that's initializing them and getting them all set up. And if we go down, I'm just going to scroll by all these. For example, there's one of our pointer pressed functions. And you can see that now it's taking in a pointer event arguments. Different than the keyboard one we talked about, which is also different than the mouse one, and so on. And things inside that, actually, there's things like the current point, so where the pointer is. And you can see that we're using that. We're also checking its ID and position and so on. And we can do a whole bunch of operations just on the touch pointer position and so on. And I've left in, there's also these if defs that if you want to define move look controller trace, just define it somewhere in your code, then it'll start debug tracing all of the stuff you're doing, your positioning of your finger and your mouse cursor and your button presses. You'll see all that printed out so that you can
Yeah, when you're tracking bugs, it's always nice to have that kind of stuff.
Yeah, definitely. So I've left that in so you can track what input you think you're sending and then whether or not the sumo's running the wrong direction, that kind of stuff. So that those are in here as well. And again, depending on what state we're in when we're moving the pointer around, we may want to actually move the position of things, and in other times we might want to do nothing. So it depends on these internal move look controller states again have come up. When we're waiting for input, we go ahead and we let them move the mouse around and so on. And of course, if we're actually playing the game, then we're more in pointer device touch mode as opposed to the mode up here where we're moving the mouse around. So the pointer is in the move control area, so you have to make sure your finger is in that bottom left corner, that square that we have, so that you are moving it around. If it is in there, then that effectively simulates a D-pad touch event, is what I've decided to simulate, and so you are moving the guy around, as long as your finger's in that box. However, if your finger is not in that box, then I treat it as if you are effectively playing around with the camera outside that box and so on. So you can also control the camera as well as the character, and just scrolling through all this stuff, that's basically what's going on there. There's our pointer moved. If I keep going down here, that's all the rotations and everything. We have on mouse moved. So this is the similar approach, but now for the mouse. And again, we can see it takes a mouse event arguments. And inside that, there's things like the change in the mouse's position in X and Y. Okay, it's known as mouse delta. Delta represents change. Also why we have delta time often in games, the amount of time that's changed on each frame. Okay, so we have our mouse delta, and we just take out the X and the Y position from that. We're just going to cast that into a float so we can use it a little bit a little more easily. We also have some rotation gain on there, which is just scaling the control for sensitivity purposes.
Yeah, so you just don't, the camera just doesn't fly out of the screen.
Or so that you don't have to move your mouse entirely across the table, to get it to work. And you could, those are just defined so you can go ahead and change them to whatever you feel is right for your game, or rather even the scale of your game, because some games are larger and you need to manipulate where you're moving a bit more. So that's always nice to have in all games, that kind of mouse scaling ability. And again, we then update our orientation based on the command, so we might change our pitch and yaw of the camera and so on because they've moved their mouse around. We want to limit the pitch. That's where I'm limiting it, right there, in case anybody wants to remove those limits or play with them just to see that it does work. That's our max and min pitch that we're limiting. And then we're going to keep the longitude in the same range by wrapping it around so that it's within a certain value of pi plus or minus. That's all similar reason to why I was doing that for the sumo early on to make sure he doesn't rotate in the wrong direction after a certain point. This is just to keep pi within a constrained number so it never looks like 5 million. And you're like, how many rotations is that? I don't know. Okay, so it just keeps it in a constrained value that's more human readable. But that's about it for that. On pointer released, I'm just going to skip by that one again. That's when you take your finger off, on pointer exited, and so on. There's our on key down, and here you can see, again, key event arguments, but now we have our W key check, our S, our A, our D, space, X as well, because you can actually fly the guy up and down just for trying to find him on the screen. It was in there. You can move the guy around. Of course, it's not great for the game because then he's flying off into space and you can't bump each other and so on.
It's a cheat code.
Yeah, it's like a cheat code effectively. But it's just to show you that, I mean, you can put in anything you want in here besides what we're actually using and then drive code off these variables to do whatever else you want. Okay, so and then there's our pause key, which is P. So on the keyboard, we can pause by hitting that and so on, and that'll instruct everything. So key up, like we said, was going to be exactly the same, except now it's going to set everything to false. So again, still a key event args. When we get this, we grab what key we're dealing with, and we just unset the appropriate variable, except for a case in pause, we only actually want to do it on button down. So it's a toggle button, right? So they push it, and it turns on or off, depending on what the state it was. So we handle that one differently by just verifying was it on or off, and then effectively setting it to the opposite thing. But in this case, when we let up, we don't want to do anything. If we are paused, we set a flag saying that pause pressed is true and pause is false, and we can toggle in and out, and that way every two button clicks really does what we want as opposed to just
the
letting
single,
go of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a good pause button if you had to hold P on your keyboard and then try to go to the bathroom. That just doesn't work out very well. You have to let go of that button to be able to go anywhere else and do whatever you wanted to do when you pause the game. So we've set it up as a toggle to support that kind of setup. Okay, so that effectively is all of the code for capturing the input. Actually, sorry, I did forget one thing. Let me go to the controller part for this. So, actually, there we go. So we'll go through the update function. The update function gets called by the main update loop, goes in as part of that, and the very first thing we're going to do is check for that game input, game pad input, because it is different than everything else we do. So if we jump over to that, all right, first, if the controller is not connected, then there isn't much point in doing anything. So we go ahead and we verify whether or not the device is connected, and we check for the controller connection by trying to get its capabilities. So we can use the X input get capabilities method, which will tell us whether or not this gamepad, in this case, does exist, and we did get something back. If we did, we can go ahead and say, yes, there is, in fact, a game controller connected, and we'd like to use it. And currently the start button is not in use, so we're just initializing that state. So if we go down here, of course, at that point, maybe perfectly right between when we detected it was in there, they yanked the cord, and it's now no longer in there. So again, we can check, and if it's not there, we can say, oh, darn, the device is no longer connected, and do something about that.
I've kicked a few cables out in my day, so.
It always happens. You drop something, or somebody runs by the TV or whatever, and you know, not playing with a wireless controller, you can lose it. So we have that, just sort of that protection in there. Again, we deal with our states. If we're waiting for input, the only thing they can do on the controller is push the start button to make that pop-up window go away. All right, so start allows you to move through the menus. If there is one, it just allows you to accept the message and continue on. That's all we're listening for. So we only do that when we're in the wait for input stage. If we're in the active stage, you're playing the game, or active state, sorry, we're playing the game. Again, the start button is now going to be used to pause the game. So when we're in this state and they push that X input gamepad start, all right, if that is true in this button's bit flag, so we're using a binary operator here to verify that it's true. If it is true, we know he's pushing the start button and we can do something about it. Otherwise, we're going to say that the input start button is not in use and pause pressed is true. So it's the toggle, same idea to toggle the start button. So it's every time you push it, you don't have to push and hold it to pause. That wouldn't be very useful. And that's all that that's handling there. From there, we get into how to deal with thumbsticks. And please, always, whenever you're dealing with thumbsticks, any kind of analog device like that, always include a dead zone.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, there are games on a couple of other smaller platforms that are hobbyist platforms that I can't mention. I've noticed a lot of the games don't have a dead zone, yet they have a controller to play with. Mm-hmm. So when you do that, you move the guy and then you take your hand off the stick. The guy keeps running very slowly in one direction just because the stick is slightly leaning to the left.
Well, they wear out after use.
And there is that too. But it's something that more of the AAA developers understand, always put a dead zone in. Mm-hmm. But it's something that new programmers and people new to game creation might forget to do. So always please include a small dead zone. And I've defined a small dead zone here for it so that the stick has a little bit of toggle room to wear down and not really, you know, if it gets loose, it won't actually make the guy move around. So it's just something I always like to point out to people because it can be easily overlooked. We got to do it in both X and Y direction. And now once we've done that, we go ahead and actually grab the input from the gamepad for that thumb, whether it's left or X or left Y. And we divide it by the full range of the value, which is this here. And that gives us sort of what we're going to do. And we can convert that into a movement command number in some way, depending on, again, what input is useful for you. In this case, just dividing it by X there of the absolute float value of it to get the value I want, subtracting it from whatever is currently in there. And that gives us what we want. And Y, similar setup. And that's all just for the left thumbstick. The right thumbstick, of course, we got to do the same exact thing, but this time it's going to control the pointer change. So we're going to actually manipulate the pointer delta as you move the right thumbstick around, and that'll effectively allow us to control The camera and other things like that. It's going to be a little bit of a different range of values that we're looking for, and that's why I'm doing it that way. Whereas the left stick, really, I just want negative one to positive one for which direction we're moving our sumo wrestler and so on. So it's a little bit of a different of input. And again, this is all going to be your custom game, whatever you need.
Well, this would be something similar to like an acceleration for like a car
sure.
or something like that.
Yeah, you could do something like that on the stick or whatever. It's just going to maybe give you a curve instead of a straight linear value mm-hmm. or something like that. But really, the way you get at that value is that part there. What you choose to do with it after that fact is up to you and specific to your game. But that's how you access it from the input state at the beginning that we grabbed. Okay, and that's the same for the majority of the gamepad's options, including that start button and so on as we go through. So all that data's come in. I'm now going to just customize that rotation into the pitch and yaw for the camera and other things like that. Limit it again, just like we did with the mouse. Limit it so that it's within the proper ranges. And that's pretty much it. So that's how we effectively listen for what we care for from the controller. And then that, of course, would come jump back out. If I go back once more, and continue on with the rest of the update function. So now we've set up all of the stuff according to whatever the gamepad is saying. Now, of course, we can do things like check for any mouse input. So if the mouse is being moved, then we should calculate that same pointer delta that we just saw a second ago from the right stick, but now in terms of because they're moving the mouse. So effectively, it's just going to overwrite whatever. If somebody's using the controller and the mouse, it's just going to overwrite what the controller input was now with the mouse input. And so effectively, only one of them is going to get through. Now, I don't know which one they intend to actually use. All I know is there are two things trying to tell me to move something in some way. So the order in which I've coded them is just the order I picked. But if you wanted to give preference, the thing you want to be the last authority say is the one you put last, right? So if I switch this call to the controller to the end, then it would have priority say.
Or you could do something like a case in here. To check to see if there's a controller plugged in, take that input. If not, maybe just default to the mouse.
And we've already done that. Because inside that, we do check, is there a controller? If not, don't do anything.
Yeah, exactly.
But in the case where two are plugged in, I can't tell necessarily which one is the one that should win, unless we had some option to let them choose that. Yes, I would like to only do this. Well, then I would use an if statement and just disable all that. You're right.
Okay.
Exactly. But if you cared about order, you can put them in the order that you want, whereas the least useful one goes first and the preferential one goes last.
So in our case, we're going to want to put the dance pad last?
That's right. Yeah. The dance pad would go last. If you're going to put that in there, it might as well be the best one to use. Yeah. So again, we get all that information from the move. We continue on from the mouse. And you can see the mouse is also doing the move commands if we are in that mode versus the trying to click on a menu button and so on. And then here we can see where we're checking those simple Booleans. So if forward is true, well, it could be true because they're pushing W. Okay. If it is, well, then I'm going to overwrite again the move command to be move forward as fast as I can. All right. So now it wins over any of the other ones. So I can push as many of these as I want to make movement command Y all all forward, but it won't matter because in the end the keyboard is going to be the one that wins, and and that's it. So all those extra inputs just get overwritten each time you try it on a different device, and that's fine. And that just simplifies all the problems we need to worry about. We don't have to worry about any of those problems anymore. They're all gone. Okay. If you're ever pushing two of those same directions on two different input devices, we override it and only end up using one of them in the end. So just all those bools, just setting all those values. And then we're making sure that the 45 degree cases aren't faster. We don't want you to be able to say, I want to move forward and to the right, therefore going at 1.707 times your speed in that direction. And obviously you can see I've done that quite a bit because I know what that number is, running on that diagonal, which of course is just a squared plus b squared c squared, square rooted, the usual Pythagorean theorem setup. So we're just going to check if any of these cases are beyond the tolerance of pushing in that direction, that we're going to go ahead and we're going to normalize the move command's direction as a vector in that, so that it will only be a length of 1, regardless of what direction. So it's effectively creating a circle of radius 1, and your move vector, your velocity effectively, is constrained to 0 to 1 in any direction as a vector's magnitude. That's all that that's doing. So it removes that ability to go faster on a diagonal angle. And that's what that does. And then as we go through here, there's things like sensitivity adjustments, rotating the command to align with our direction. So depending on how you rotate the camera, pushing forward means something different. It's relative to the camera. And that's quite common in a lot of games, you know, shooters. You're looking in one direction with your stick, and then you move or strafe left and right with your other stick, right? It's the same thing I've set up here just to show you how that works so you have all the math behind it. You can move the camera, and then if you push forward, you'll see the sumo guy no longer runs straight up the mat. He'll now move forward to the camera's rotation and so on, and that's all that that's doing right there. It's setting that up, and then we're doing the sensitivity adjustment for it. And finally, at the end, we can go ahead and clear the movement command because we've now set all those values into the velocity vector, which is what the game will be accessing from the move controller. It will simply ask, what is the velocity, please? And we will apply that to the player's cube to move in that direction. So in the end, that's all we need is that M velocity value. All the inputs get crushed right down into that in terms of the player's input.
Very cool. So yeah, that's a good way of doing the input, and we're really getting close to having a game now. We've got everything rendering up on the screen. We're able to move them around. So I don't know, you want to take a 10-minute break? When we come back, we'll talk about how to add physics and handle some collisions.
Sounds good.